This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Not so long ago, it was impossible to watch sports or almost anything else on TV without hearing a lot of ads for FanDuel and DraftKings. Those two companies and others invited fans to bet on fantasy lineups composed of actual players whose actual statistics would determine how well those fantasy teams performed.
Just choose a league, pick your team, and get your cash winnings after Monday night.
Last year, NFL owners Jerry Jones and Robert Kraft were among the many high rollers bankrolling the enterprise, but according to a recent ESPN story, the companies are now half the size they were then. In part, that's because in some states, the game they offer has been characterized as illegal gambling rather than a legal endeavor based on skill. The distinction probably didn't matter to lots of the players.
So there are people that are going to throw their $3 in just for the entertainment. It's like holding a lottery ticket while you watch the balls come out of the hopper. In gambling nomenclature, that's called a sweat.
That's John Sullivan. His personal story may shed some light on what's happened to the industry. 10 years ago, he started playing daily fantasy sports because he felt he'd be better than lots of other people at figuring out who might play well on any given Sunday. Still, he was careful.
I'm a pretty skeptical guy, so I played very small dollar amounts in the beginning.
Putting together fantasy lineups made watching the actual players in the actual games more interesting. It was fun, and then one day it became lucrative.
During football season, which is like the Christmas shopping season of daily fantasy, that's when they have the most users and the most engagement. I played about 30 contests, which was a lot for me back then, and that was the first day, it was just Sunday, a Sunday football day, where I made over $1,000. That was a tipping point for me. That was where it went from, you know, just a social activity to this could be a job for me.
The job eventually expanded to include a more certain revenue stream. As an affiliate marketer, Sullivan recruited other players for the fantasy gaming websites.
Every player that you sign up to the site, you get a small percentage of the money they spend on the site.
He handed out business cards at sporting events in Buffalo, inviting people to sign up. Those who did got weekly lineups in their inboxes. Sullivan made a little more extra money consulting for the websites, telling them how he thought they might make what they had to offer more attractive to the gamblers. I'm sorry, players.
I was one of the better players in the beginning, and around 2011, I think I had my best day ever. I won three tournaments on an NFL Sunday on FanDuel, and I made about $12,000 in one day. And to me, that was a lot of money. This is what actually went through my head. Will I be able to do this again?
No. Sullivan, who played under the name Buffalo 66, never did have another day like that. And then,
over a period of years, I would say from 2013 to 2015, the industry went away from what I enjoyed about it. But ultimately, the decision was made for me when New York outlawed daily fantasy.
By that point, the product had changed. Thousands of players were competing against each other, and unbeknownst to the majority, a few of those players were exceptionally well prepared.
They're data scientists. They're people that have advanced degrees, and the sites are slowly getting better at doing things about it, but it's still 90% of the players are pretty much being led to slaughter here.
Sullivan also noticed that the sites had begun taking a bigger cut of the money being bet, and he asked himself a basic question.
Am I getting a fair game when I play? Am I getting a fair game?
Sullivan didn't think so he pulled back. He still creates fantasy lineups for games in the Canadian Football League just for the fun of it. He gives them away. And he still collects a commission for the players he steered toward the sites. But he's also speaking out against the preposterous odds against beating this particular game. So what would happen if one of those people to whom he'd handed his business card on a snowy day at New Era Field in Buffalo called him up and asked him how to sign up? Because as of this week, it's legal again to do that in New York.
The first thing I would say to him is, have you played daily fantasy sports before? That's the first thing I would say to him.
If not, Sullivan would point the aspiring player to sources of information about how much the house makes on each bet and about the sharks he or she would be playing against, though he wouldn't necessarily tell the player not to play.
I feel like if this is an activity you want to participate in, you're a grown-up and you can do that.
If you're a grown-up or even a kid who wants to know a lot more about the rise and the apparent fall of the daily fantasy sports industry, check out Don Van Natta's ESPN article titled Welcome to the Big Time. There's a link to it at onlyagame.org.
I love to climb mountains all over the world. Here, the highest thing I have is Moe's Mountain.
That's Morris Burke, a.k.a. Moe, and this is his mountain. Actually, it's a hole at Sandwich Mini Golf, a course Burke began building 66 years ago out of a boggy tidal plain on Cape Cod. Running the summer business hasn't always been easy for Moe and his wife Sylvia. Their land is now worth over $1 million, and even though they're beyond the traditional age of retirement, they say they won't sell. Why? Here's Only a Game's Gary Wallach.
I've played Sandwich Mini Golf almost every summer since I was 5 years old. It's a lovable little course, wedged between Route 6A and a salt marsh. A bubbling brook flows under the course's many bridges, around a simulated giant lily pad, and past a white whale and a tiny lighthouse. Earlier this summer, Mo, Sylvia, and I sat down inside a little barn filled with landscaping equipment and a Model A Ford that gleams like it's just been driven off the lot. Mo tells me that the land on which the course is built has been in Burke's family for about a century.
My grandfather had a kind of a little farm on the edge of the marsh, and it had a cranberry bog. In 1930, the state decided to put a superhighway through, and it split up the cranberry bog, so it was just a few cranberries left, enough cranberries to eat, but the swamp had no real value at the time.
As a kid, the only thing Mo spent money on was mini golf, so he came up with a plan. In 1950, at the age of 15, he began work on a course, single-handedly.
It was swamp reclamation, so it took a few years just to fill in the swamp. My dad had an old truck, so I could get 5 loads of sand in an hour if I shoveled really fast. My first goal was to get 9 holes.
Cape Cod tourism grew steadily in the 1950s and 60s, so Mo had every reason to believe his course could be a moneymaker from the outset, even in sleepy, traditional Sandwich, a town that has always maintained tight control on development. Mo knew his mini golf would have to win the approval of tourists and town fathers, so he focused on the land's natural features.
I was just kind of working along the stream, and then another hole that came quickly after was Treasure Island, when I diverted the stream, and we had to dig all these tons of mud and dirt and sand out to make an island. A lot of people thought I was crazy. That'll never work. Luckily, when my wife married me, she didn't put her foot down and say, "What are you doing?"
Sylvia told me at the outset that she didn't want to be part of the interview, but when Mo started talking about their lives and their golf course, she couldn't help herself.
When I married this man, Morris Burke, it was a great blessing. He is a gentleman with a heart of love.
I look over at Mo. Sylvia's words have him fighting back tears.
I believed in him, even when the mini golf only had 9 holes. We had a sign 18 holes, and people would say, "Well, where are the other 9? I said, "Well, you play these twice." And that's the way we started.
We've been married for 59 years this summer. She's gone through the good times and the bad. When I opened, there weren't a lot of customers. If I took in $10, that was a lot because we only charged 50 cents. I just had faith that if I built it, someone would come.
They didn't come to the Burke's putting greens of dreams, not right away. But Mo and Sylvia had another kind of faith. So while they waited for their business to take off, they took missionary jobs in South America.
From 64 to 68, we were in Ecuador, teaching in Christian schools. When we came home, we continued. I'm sure there are times when we weren't sure how we were going to pay our next bill. We prayed over the golf course every step of the way, because it's what you call a faith type thing. For the next 10 years, I pretty much finished it. By the mid-70s, it was starting to take in some money. It took a few years before it really was a legitimate mini golf.
By this time, Cape Cod's tourism industry had exploded. There were more attractions everywhere, including bigger, glitzier mini-golf courses. But Cape Cod is a summer destination, and the Burkes felt there was more missionary work to do overseas. They went to Taiwan for 12 years.
So we would just come home in the summer, but usually every summer I would add a hole. So by the end of our stay in Taiwan, which was 96, I think we had it well underway towards 36 holes.
After more than three decades, the Burkes retired from teaching. They remain in the mini golf business. As parts of Cape Cod have gone the way of mega malls, shopping outlets, and gated condo villages, their throwback mini golf has endured, quaintly and defiantly. Mo is now in his 80s. He and Sylvia could sell the course, pocket the $1 million, and just relax. But they won't sell. After 66 years of working on the course, Mo just doesn't seem to know how to stop.
And even in the winter, he's repainting. In the evening hours, he'll be busy carving signs. Every sign that's on the mini golf is all hand-carved by him.
Some of those brown and white signs depict little smiling whales that indicate hole number. Some contain rules, directions to the next hole, or snippets of psalms. There must be 200 of them. Mo says he plans to give the business to his son, David. But for now, there are customers on the course. He needs to get back to water flowers, reposition cobblestones, tidy the parking lot, and greet visitors. I love Sandwich Mini Golf because each time I play there, I feel like a kid. My wife and children seem to love it as much as I do. It's one of our very happy places. When we left the course after a recent visit, Morris Burke told me he looked forward to seeing us again at his mini golf. Barring that, he said, someday we'd meet in heaven. I wonder, does Mo Burke see any difference between the two? For Only a Game, I'm Gary Wallach.
There's lots more to come on Only a Game, but while you're thinking about it, consider leaving us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. It helps other listeners find our podcast, and we always like to hear your thoughts on our show. I'm Bill Littlefield. Oh, what's that? It's the sound of the new college football season. But this week on Three Stories You Should Know, we're not going to talk about powerhouses like Alabama or Oklahoma. We're going to talk about a team from Division III. Joining me now are Will Leach from Sports on Earth and Claire McNear from The Ringer. Welcome to both of you.
Hello.
Thank you so much.
Claire, tell us about this Division III football team.
So my alma mater, the University of Chicago, is decidedly not a football school. It was once, a long, long time ago. It was a co-founder of the Big Ten. It was home of the first Heisman Trophy, routinely played in front of crowds of 50,000. And then the team was disbanded in the 30s by a president who, he had some quote about saying every time he felt the urge to exercise, he would lie down until it passed. But football eventually came back in the 70s, and the team has often not been very good. But now the school wants more. So they hired a new coach in 2013, and they also took on a new athletic director, and they came from Dartmouth and Princeton, respectively. The university has been pouring money into building out homecoming as a big event for alumni to come to and families to go to, and with drinks, tailgating, which does not exist at the University of Chicago, or at least did not in recent years. I was just there, not that long ago. And I mean, there's this old joke on campus that most kids don't even know there is a football team. So they've started posting flyers around campus explaining the basic rules of the game. This is what a touchdown is. Unclear if they're meant to be parody, but they're there nonetheless. So I guess the question is, how do you build a football culture at a school that doesn't have one?
Well, I am a graduate of the University of Illinois Champaign, and so I've been watching the Illinois football team for a long time. So I know this seems like a hard, difficult project for the University of Chicago, but the bar to clear the best college football program in the state of Illinois is actually quite low. This is actually not going to be too hard for the University of Chicago. So they were an original member of the Big Ten. I remember being a kid and being very confused that Illinois and Chicago had once been the Big Ten together. And Claire, I think there's a mention in your piece, the idea that there basically is an ongoing standing invitation to get Chicago back in the Big Ten. I am supportive of this idea. They certainly make more sense of the Big Ten than Rutgers.
I'm not sure why a college would think it's a good idea to crank up a football program these days, even Division III. Maybe this is because I've been reading too many stories about football players who wish they'd taken up another sport instead. As far as I'm concerned, a campus where students don't know there's a football team is preferable to one where they have a football team and paint their faces funny colors in order to support it. Maybe it's just me.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a way that you can do both a little bit. The University of Chicago is proudly Division III. They talk a lot about how their athletes are students first, and they'll miss practice to go to a class or you know, study for a test or something like that. But having been in Hyde Park for 4 years, I think that, you know, if there's some fun on the weekends that everybody can get excited about, that probably wouldn't be a terrible thing.
All right, moving to baseball. Last I heard, and maybe I wasn't paying enough attention, former Cardinals manager Tony La Russa accomplished the incredible feat of going out on top as a World Series winner. But I wasn't paying enough attention to the National League West, at least. Will, what's going on?
The author William Goldman has a great quote saying that baseball managers wake up every morning with the knowledge that sooner or later they're going to get fired. Tony La Russa was the one manager, a Hall of Fame manager, one of the three most winning managers of all time. In 2011, in mid-August, he privately told his bosses, I'm going to retire at the end of this season. During that season, the Cardinals were 10 games out of first place. What happened? This Cardinal fan is happy to tell you. The Cardinals made an incredible comeback and ended up winning the World Series in the most exciting way possible. So La Russa really had this moment, which means, of course, he has come back and ruined it. So he decided that he could not, like many competitors, Tony La Russa wanted to get back out there. So he's not a manager. He's the general manager of the Arizona Diamondbacks. The Diamondbacks have turned into a disaster in the 2 years that La Russa has been running them. The idea that this Hall of Famer, the third winningest manager of all time, the guy that went out in the perfect way, he just could not let it go. And now he's getting to the situation that all managers face. He's going to get fired like all of them do.
I mean, certainly that, you know, he's suffering in the present. But I think in the end, you know, his record is going to go down as what it is, which is very successful. And probably the darker patches will be glossed over in the end. I'm interested in, you know, whether it's more difficult to accept success and walk away as a manager or as an athlete, and, you know, what it is that drives the person to come back.
It's interesting because a player can fool themselves into thinking, I can do it myself. Michael Jordan would be the most famous example of this. Coming back to Washington, he's like, trust me, I'm Michael Jordan. I'm going to win championships. I can do it. It did not. And now we all try to pretend that didn't happen. Maybe that's what happened with Tony La Russa. But I think with a manager, you know, I think most managers, and La Russa may be the exception on this, most managers understand that the success of their team is mostly out of their control. Earl Weaver famously said that the reason the manager is the one that gets thrown out of the game is because you don't really need a manager. The manager can go and the team will be just fine. And so I think that La Russa has always kind of felt like he can control things and he can make things happen. And I think that ultimately may end up being his fatal flaw.
This does bring up, Will, one of those sports topics that never dies. Some people, of course, are going to say Tony La Russa should have taken advantage of the opportunity to go out on top because, as you say, it's an opportunity managers almost never get. But managers, like athletes, have to be allowed the opportunity to exercise free will. It's not finally my business to say Willie Mays should have retired before he did, although it still sort of hurts to remember him stumbling in center field, and it's I'm sorry. I'm going to have to stop now and send it back to you, Will.
Oh, heavens. That's like a very dark. Well, if it does make you feel better, I, as someone that was not around when Willie Mays finished his career, I only think of Willie Mays doing amazing things.
And that's how it should be. Yes. Exactly. No matter when somebody retires. I want to talk about baseball as well. The Chicago White Sox announced this week that the ballpark in which they play will be known as Guaranteed Rate Field. And the new name has nothing to do with holding down ticket prices. It has to do with a company that bought the naming rights to the place. Among the alternative suggestions that have already surfaced on Twitter are, we still call it Comiskey Park anyway, Field. Probably the most honest name for the stadium would be guaranteed to be called Guaranteed Rate until some other corporation offers us more, Field, or for simplicity's sake, For Sale Stadium, something like that. This has been going on for a long time. I hope the Dodgers always play in Dodger Stadium. I hope Wrigley Field continues to be Wrigley Field. Can somebody come up with a better name for the place in Chicago?
I saw a lot of Twitter was suggesting it should be like Harambe Park.
Harambe Park.
Twitter recommends that for everything.
This is true. But I really do think Harambe would have loved it.
My general thought on this is when a company signs a deal with a stadium, even if the company goes out of business, it should be stuck with that name forever. The example I use on this in 2000-2001, Enron Field in Houston, Texas, they signed a deal for the Astros to be playing there, a 30-year deal. I think the best punishment that the Houston Astros could have gotten for making that name is it would have to still, in 2016 until 2030, be known as Enron Field. I think that I still call it Enron Field today. It's Minute Maid Park, but to my mind, it's always Enron Field. And, you know, to me, that is a large part of the fun of this. You can name it whatever you want. Barry Petrovsky wrote a great piece for Deadspin about this, about how, you know, you can call it Guaranteed Rate Field. You can call it the unfortunate logo with an arrow going down, which that'll get the crowd excited when they go to White Sox games. But you really can call it whatever you want. You can call it this. You can call it Comiskey Park. You can call it White Sox Place, because deep down, the White Sox, they have to call it this horrible name. The sponsors have to call it this horrible name, but we're not getting any money from them, so we can call it whatever we want.
I mean, you know, just anything, even with an arrow pointing up or in an upward direction, would have been an improvement.
My guests for this week's three stories you should know have been The Ringer's Claire McNear and Sports on Earth's Will Leach. Thank you both.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Earlier in the show, we heard a story about daily fantasy sports. Now we turn to fantasy sports of another kind, the kind where groups of friends and friends of friends face off throughout an entire season. And unlike in real sporting events, where the focus is on what the winners win, a trophy, a ring, a lot of money, sometimes in fantasy sports, the focus is on the losers or loser. Why? Because some leagues have punishments for whoever comes in last. Only a Game's Martin Kessler set out to find the very worst of those.
When's the last time you wrote with a pencil? Not a pen, like with an actual number 2 pencil. It was week 7 when I really started asking myself that question. Let me explain. In week 7 of the 2015 NFL season, my fantasy football team lost its 5th straight game. I won't bore you with the injury reports, but Team Kessler was dropping down the standings. In our league, a group of my recently graduated friends from college had a punishment. The person who finished last had to take the SAT again. That would mean paying $50 for a 4-hour reminder that trigonometry is not like riding a bicycle. Over the next few weeks, when I took a break from desperately scanning the waiver wire for useful players, I started to wonder if anyone playing in another fantasy football league might be dreading an even worse punishment. And that's what led me to Jackson Logie.
I think I took Tom Brady in the first round, and maybe should look the running back route instead.
It's about 2:30 on a sunny Saturday afternoon, 2 months after the end of the 2015 fantasy season, when I meet Jackson Logie, or as one of his friends affectionately calls him, Jackson the Loser Logie. Manhattan bars are typically bad places for radio interviews, but Jackson's hoping to calm his nerves a little bit, because in a couple hours, he's scheduled to perform a stand-up comedy routine, and...
I'm not gonna lie, I'm pretty nervous. I'm not a generally funny person.
Jackson is not a stand-up comic. He doesn't even want to be one. But he does play fantasy football, and the last place owner in his league was required to perform at an open mic.
The whole high school league, some other friends, friends of friends, coworkers, all the guys I work with are coming. So there's absolutely a worst case scenario. I couldn't barely sleep last night. I think the worst case scenario is getting up there and just not remembering anything.
I leave Jackson. He says he's got notes to review and a couple more IPAs to drink before showtime, and take my spot at the venue, the basement of another bar. There's a mic set up in the middle of the room. The tables surrounding it are soon full. 15 to 20 amateur comics are scheduled to perform, but almost everyone in the audience is here to see Jackson. Jackson begins his routine by setting low expectations.
This is going to be really, really painful for all of you, and it's going to suck. And to be honest, I really should have tried to get out of it, and I didn't. I feel badly about it. And I used to have this buddy back in college who tried to get out of everything, absolutely everything.
Jackson tells the story of a college friend who wasn't prepared when his teaching assistant called on him.
He immediately looks down and just goes, "Phone call, I gotta take this." And he just books it out of the room. Everyone's like, okay, whatever, that's obviously fake.
Jackson goes on for another couple minutes before realizing enough is enough.
That's all I got. Thank you guys for coming.
After the cheers die down, I pull Jackson aside for a quick debrief.
I blacked out. I have no idea what I said.
Will he ever take the stage again?
Absolutely not.
This is one time enough.
One time thing. I did it. It's fine. It was awesome. And that's that.
It was awesome? That doesn't sound so bad. So I started searching Twitter for things like fantasy football punishment and miserable. That's how I found Steve Clark. He works as a school psychologist in New York State's North Country. He plays in a fantasy league with some of the kids he used to coach on the JV baseball team.
It's pretty cutthroat. I thought I was going to outsmart all the young guys, but I can't keep up.
His league decided that the top three finishers would get the honor of creating a personalized punishment for the loser. So when Steve, one of the only Red Sox fans in town, came in last, he had an idea of where it was headed.
So I assumed I would have to wear Yankee gear. The political one stung a little bit more than that.
Turns out, supporting the Red Sox isn't the only thing that makes Steve unusual.
I live in upstate New York, which is a tremendously conservative area of New York State. And there's not a whole lot of us Democrats up here. So they have this baseball hat that says, "Make America Great Again." So they decided that my punishment was that I had to pose as a Donald Trump supporter. At first they thought I should have to wear this baseball hat in school where I work, but then they decided, no, it might be better to have it as my profile picture on my Twitter account.
And they told Steve that he had to make the picture look authentic and not tell anyone why he'd done it. Otherwise, they'd make the punishment even worse. So
I, sat on my deck with my Make America Great Again hat. I was holding an American flag, a bottle of Jim Beam bourbon, and one of my son's hunting rifles. My son took the picture, and it went up on my Twitter account. All the phone calls started coming. I have two daughters. They were calling me right away. What's happened to Dad? What's going on? We're concerned.
It got worse for the school psychologist.
Our school principal got a message from our district superintendent who just said, is something going on with Steve? He's our primary mental health service provider here in school, and he's posing with a rifle and a bottle of bourbon.
Okay, putting your job at risk for fantasy football? A punishment can't get worse than that, right? But then Steve finished the story.
Slowly over the time, they knew it was just a joke. But it was a lot of fun. We had a lot of fun with it.
Enough fun, apparently, that Steve is signed up for the coming season, though he's been warned about a repeat performance.
Basically, what they said is, I better not finish last again, because if I do, the punishment will be doubled. But I'm in a panic because I do not want to finish last again.
Unaspiring comic Jackson the Loser Logie and his buddies already have their new punishment picked out, last place has to earn $10 playing street music in Central Park. Neither Jackson nor any of his friends play instruments. But I still wonder, is that or wearing a Trump hat or the stand-up comedy routine really worse than the SAT? Because I never found out. The waiver wire paid off, and Team Kessler finished in a respectable pre-ante-penultimate place. That's, I studied my SAT vocab words for fourth from last. And I'd ask the actual loser of our league, a guy named Edward Benjamin Samuels from Pasadena, California, but unlike Steve Clark or Jackson the Loser Logie, he chickened out of his punishment. Which makes me think, the SAT must really be the worst.
That's only a Games Martin Kessler. His league hasn't settled on a punishment for this season yet, but maybe getting called out on NPR is the start of a new tradition. We'll be right back with Charlie Pierce and more sports NPR style. Next week on the podcast, former NFL tight end Ben Utecht explains why he decided to write down his memories for his wife and daughters.
It's a difficult thing to explain, you know, to sit across from family and friends and hear stories and memories, and everybody at the table remembers, you know, why can't I remember that?
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a math teacher uses his basketball bias to motivate his students. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
The most accomplished female soccer goalie of this or any other time has had her contract with the national team terminated, and she has been suspended for 6 months for referring to an opposing team as, quote, cowards. Would any other player, female or male, have been as severely disciplined as Hope Solo was?
No, this is purely a PR move. It's really a ridiculous penalty to be levied by the people who run U.S. soccer. What she said deserves a stern talking to in somebody's office. But to ban her for 6 months for something she said is just ridiculous.
Meanwhile, Richard Chaplow, who plays soccer for the Orange County Blues, was suspended for 2 games and fined an undisclosed amount for calling Robbie Rogers of the LA Galaxy a queer lots of times during a recent game. Let's see, 6 months for calling the other team cowards, 2 games for calling the first openly gay pro soccer player in the U.S. a queer. That doesn't somehow sound right.
How many times do I have to tell you that soccer doesn't make sense on almost any level?
On an administrative level.
Yeah, it's right. Mad. Are you kidding?
Peter Malachowski, a discus thrower from Poland, won a silver medal in Rio, Charlie, and he's auctioning off his medal to help fund medical treatment for a 3-year-old boy in Poland who's suffering from retinoblastoma. His pitch to bidders is, if you help me, my silver may be more valuable than gold. And it's suddenly gotten very dusty in here.
Yeah, this is a terrific story. The procedure to treat this particular kind of cancer is only available in New York. So not only do they have to pay for the operation and whatever comes afterwards, they also have to get the little boy to New York.
Mm-hmm.
So good for Mr. Malachowski. I hope his silver medal becomes the most valuable piece of sports memorabilia ever.
Me too. In other Olympics news, a study published this week in The Lancet suggests that by 2085, every major city in the U.S. except San Francisco will be too hot to host the Summer Olympics, unless, of course, climate change is a hoax. So get ready for Greenland 2085.
Oh, dear. I mean, and of course, San Francisco will make up for it through sheer pretension, so we can't, you know, we can't put it there anyway. By the way, if we're still having the Olympics in 2085, we have not progressed very far as a species.
A volunteer assistant for the University of North Carolina football team has decided that he will no longer be volunteering. Tim Beckman, formerly of Illinois, says he doesn't want to be a distraction for the Tar Heels. A volunteer assistant causing a distraction? Help me out with this.
Yeah, a volunteer assistant, by the way, who lost a job at a Big Ten program because he mistreated his players. And apparently, at North Carolina, he was pressuring doctors, pressuring players to play hurt. He got $250,000 in a wrongful termination suit, but it's pretty plain this guy should not be allowed to coach human beings.
In pro football news, Aaron Rodgers of the Green Bay Packers has said that he wishes more NFL players would speak out about social issues. I don't know if he has any idea why they don't. Do you?
Probably the reason they don't is because Roger Goodell can lock them in a closet if he wants to, since the Players Association idiotically gave him that power, during, as we learned to our horror during the whole Deflategate mess. He has that power to do that, and somebody better take it away from him before anybody takes Aaron Rodgers up on his suggestion.
I would agree with you. That is, in fact, reason number one. Reason number two is, and people still don't understand this in some sectors, pro football players don't have guaranteed contracts.
Exactly right. Whenever you see a football player signing a $190 million contract, understand that you're essentially reading about a phantom.
On Tuesday, Tim Tebow will work out so that he can be evaluated by scouts from 20 Major League Baseball teams. Wait, what?
It will never end. And strangely enough, by the way, Tim Tebow has a book coming out. So this baseball tryout may very well be the beginning of an extended book tour.
Yeah. When he writes another book, does he call all the NBA teams?
I was thinking NHL first.
Yeah, that's probably right. There was, of course, much worry in some quarters that Ryan Lochte had sabotaged his future by claiming that he'd been robbed at gunpoint at the Rio Olympics. Fair to say that that's not the case?
Oh, no. He's got all kinds of things. He's got all kinds of irons in the fire, Bill. First of all, he's going to be on Dancing with the Stars, you which know, is about the lowest rung on the reality
yeah,
TV totem pole.
Okay. All right. But in the past, Olympic winners got to be on Dancing with the Stars. Not guys who claim to be held up in Rio when they weren't.
Well, not just that, but he's also... Remember the movie, the original version of the Bad News Bears? Remember what the name of the sponsor for the team was? Chico's Bail Bonds. Ryan Lochte is well on his way to becoming an endorser of Chico's Bail Bonds. He's endorsing something called forgiving cough drops. They bill themselves as forgiving on your throat, which I think if you get caught vandalizing a gas station in a foreign country and then lie about being robbed at gunpoint, you need to be forgiving of more than your throat.
Yeah, I was going to say, cough drops aren't going to do it. You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated these days. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
As a new school year gets underway, I feel the need to reissue my perennial proclamation that athletes should not necessarily be held up as role models, because where's the guarantee that it'll work out when you look to an athlete for what you should do? But how about looking to athletes for what you shouldn't do? Well, that just might make you famous. Here's Only a Game's Karen Given.
I think you start any new job, you're going to be nervous on your first day.
On the second to last day of July, when our story begins, Tucker Hine didn't just have any old first day on the job jitters. He had first day at his first real job jitters.
I'm a night owl, and this whole getting up early in the adult world is kind of hard for me. So my biggest nightmare was not waking up for my alarm the first day.
Mr. Hine graduated from the University of Oklahoma in May and spent the summer preparing to teach ninth grade algebra at Indianapolis Lighthouse Charter School East.
I know that's a mouthful.
And because Mr. Hine had been training with Teach for America, he was a little behind schedule as the first day of school approached.
I was in the school on Saturday night about 1:30 in the morning, and kids come on Monday, and so I'm like scrambling to get my room ready. And I was trying to figure out how to incorporate some class rules into like a poster or something. And the only thing I was trying to do was make a rule that was like, you're going to work hard in my class. But that's very generic. Every single teacher has, oh, you're going to work hard and do all your assignments. I just wanted to do something a little bit different. That's how the whole no KD zone became a thing.
KD, as in Kevin Durant. Did I mention that Mr. Hine is an Oklahoma City Thunder fan? See, he was born and raised in Kansas, but Kansas doesn't have an NBA team. So he was a fan of the league without being a fan of a specific team. But then the Seattle Supersonics moved to nearby Oklahoma and became the Thunder.
I was like, okay, I'm just going to be a diehard Thunder fan.
As a diehard Thunder fan, Mr. Hine knew his Thunder pennant would have to be hung in his classroom, even though he was teaching in Indianapolis, land of the Pacers.
So the Thunder pennant's in the middle, and then up above it says, Mr. Hine's classroom is a no KD zone. On the bottom of the pennant, it has like three different blocks of text. One says, you will not quit on me, and I will not quit on you. Another one says, you will not take the easy way out. And I can't remember what the third one's saying. I'm drawing a blank.
You will not walk away from a challenge.
Yes, yes. You will not walk away from a challenge.
A lot of Thunder fans believe Kevin Durant walked away from a challenge when he left the Thunder to join the Golden State Warriors, the team that had just beaten Oklahoma City in the Western Conference Finals. And like a lot of Thunder fans, Mr. Hine remembers exactly where he was when he heard the news.
I was actually down in Houston training with Teach for America. I made the dumb decision to like sleep in that morning when he announced. I think it was like a Saturday.
It was a holiday Monday, July 4th at 10:38 a.m. Central Time, just in case you didn't believe Mr. Hine was really a night owl.
I slept in and woke up to about, I don't know, 20, 30 texts and all these tweet alerts and everything, and I saw all of a sudden like, oh, he's not coming back, and I threw my phone and just rolled over and went back to bed. Pretty depressing.
I hope you didn't break your phone.
I didn't. No, I kind of wanted to, but it wasn't worth that by any means.
So nearly 4 weeks later, sitting at his computer as the hours ticked by before the first day of school and still feeling the sting of Durant's departure, Mr. Hine says the three phrases just popped into his head. You will not quit on me, and I will not quit on you. You will not walk away from a challenge. You will not take the easy way out.
They were so close to beating Golden State, and they were going to be right there in the discussion next season. To bring a title to OKC would have been insane. It would have meant so much. And in my very biased opinion, I'll admit I'm very biased, but yeah, I think he took the easy way out.
Mr. Hine says his class rules come off as a bit more of a dig on Durant than he really planned. He doesn't apologize for that. But he does have one regret about his poster.
I do. It's literally just construction paper, blue and orange and Thunder colors, and then like, and just whatever font I could find on Microsoft Word. So I would have made it look a lot nicer had I known so many people were going to see it.
Because in the end, a lot of people did see that poster.
I took a picture of it. I sent it to my parents and a few friends back home. They cracked up at it. And then I was just so tired. I just passed out pretty late that night. And then the next day, I posted it to Facebook.
And what happened?
It was kind of crazy. All my social media friends started to share it and like it, and it took off over the course of a day or two in Oklahoma. And then the Oklahoma City, the local media, caught wind of it. And then from there, it kind of took off on a national scale.
ESPN shared Mr. Hine's photo on Instagram. USA Today, Fox Sports, and sports talk radio stations picked up the story. Mr. Hine was becoming Facebook famous just at the very moment he was waking up for his first day on the job.
I was just like trying to make it to work on time and have like a semi-coherent lesson plan for the day, and all of a sudden like my phone's just blowing up. I can't keep up with all of it. It definitely calmed my nerves a little bit because I just had a big distraction, so that it definitely helped.
The principal at Indianapolis Lighthouse East thought the poster was funny. He just told Mr. Hine to put in a good word for the school during interviews, and his fellow teachers seemed to get a kick out of it too. At least most of them did.
I think it was like Friday after school, so we're all excited. We made it through our first week, and then they all want to come in into my room and see the poster. And it was just kind of funny to have the whole staff in there, and a few of them were taking selfies with it and just kind of having fun with it. One was pretty mad. She goes, "I've been trying to go viral for years. You're here for a week and put up one little poster, and all of a sudden you're famous."
Well, how about the students? How did they react on the first day of school?
Oh, they talked a lot of trash. So they're not Thunder fans by any means. They understood what I was kind of getting at, but a lot of them, they were like, "Oh yeah, you should have gone to the Warriors. He wants to win a title," which you know, that's fair. But it started a lot of fun arguments in class that first day.
Teaching math to ninth graders isn't easy. Mr. Hine says it's a love it or hate it subject, and he figures he needs all the help he can get. So bantering with students about sports is a good way to break the ice. But while his no KD zone has gotten quite a lot of attention inside and outside of the classroom, Mr. Hine isn't sure his three rules will actually make his job any easier.
It's probably too soon to tell. Like I'm still getting to know the students. They're still getting to know me. We're still just getting into the very beginning of all of our content this semester. So we'll see once we get to the hard stuff, how much they want to quit or not quit.
But no one has walked away from a challenge yet.
No, nobody's packed up and moved away to San Francisco yet.
There's only one person Mr. Hine can say for sure that his poster has already helped inspire, and that's Tucker Hine.
I put that up there for the students, but like as a first-year teacher, I found myself looking at that thing too, like, all right, you told these kids they can't quit. You can't quit either.
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
I ride early in the morning by myself. It's quiet then, though I live only about a half hour from Boston. Sometimes I'll see another bicyclist coming the other way. Always he or she will be working harder than I am, going faster. If this happens on Charles River Road out past Ridge Hill, the other rider probably doesn't notice the goats that live in the front yard of one of the homes I ride past. When I go by, sometimes one of the goats looks up at me and smiles, I think. Nobody riding by in a hurry would see it. On Wilsondale Road, which winds up and down several hills, there are half a dozen blind curves. Sometimes a big group of riders will come hurtling downhill around one of those curves, shouting at each other, sometimes looking over their shoulders. If there are enough of them, and often there are, they spill across the whole road. "Yikes," I think. "Rider up," they shout in order to alert their racing companions to the oncoming plodder, me. They are a greater threat than cars, and a louder one. Once, only once, I shouted back at them as they streamed by, urging them emphatically to stay on their own side of that narrow road. As this is a story about early morning rides that are solitary and mostly peaceful, I won't recall for you what I shouted. What I might have shouted, had I thought of it, is, "You're scaring the deer!" Because I do sometimes see deer on my rides. Sometimes one will be standing in the middle of one of those narrow, winding roads, and the deer will look at me. I'll look at the deer, and then the deer will trot into the woods and disappear. It seems magical how they do that, though it's probably no big deal to them. On another road, Claybrook, I can count on seeing two donkeys who live in a shed next to a house where there used to be several rabbit hutches. The hutches are gone now. I don't know what happened to the rabbits. Neither of the donkeys is ever bothered by me. Sometimes, if they're not eating, they look up when I pass. I like to think they approve of my pace. I see horses, too, in a couple of different fields. Once I saw a fox, just once. It was several shades of light brown, and it was running up a hill along a wide trail that had been cut out under a power line. That was a memorable day. But almost any ride is enjoyable, at least before and after the howling Alp riders whiz by. I'm told riding a bicycle for an hour or so is healthy exercise, even if you aren't dressed in spandex, and that's fine. My heart and I are glad to know it's good for us. I'd also do it if it weren't. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Martin Kessler. We had help this week from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. We say goodbye this week to intern Ian Foster, who was a joy to have around the office, and not just because he's smart enough to appreciate the beautiful game. Can we make sure our next intern also likes soccer? Our final word comes from Claire McNear, who has something to say about the short list of vital folks who produce this program.
They're all scum.
Gee, I always thought Claire was the nice one. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more Sports NPR style on Only a Game. Thank you for listening.